Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. On this week's podcast, Tudor Dixon told the media late last week to do its job. This week, MERS asks the Republican gubernatorial candidate what she meant by that tweet, among other questions. Former aide to Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Mark Burton, now with the Honigman Law Firm, gives his insights on the 2022 election cycle. And Michigan Health and Hospital Association CEO Brian Peters talks about the challenges in the healthcare industry. Now here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. We're going to start the podcast off today with Mark Burton. He is a former advisor with Governor Gretchen Whitmer. He has been in politics for a long time. I think we got knowing each other when you worked for the trial attorneys back in the day. That seems like eons ago, Mark.
Yeah, no, it really is a while ago. And in the period of time that I was there, they were the Michigan Trial Lawyers Association, and they changed their name to now the Michigan Association for Justice. So, yeah, I started work for them and late 05 and then left the end of 07 when I went to run the stem cell statewide ballot campaign. So yeah, long time ago, Kyle, but you know, we're old friends at this point and both been around too long.
You've also been the head of the MEDC and now you're with the Honigman firm. And we wanted to bring you in here just to kind of tap your background and your knowledge. You were intimately involved in the 2018 campaign with Governor Whitmer. And I wanted to just kind of get what you are perceiving here from the outside. How is this campaign for 2022 different from what we saw in 2018 with Governor Whitmer?
Yeah, so, you know, 2018, the fundamentals of that race were obviously a lot different. Bill Schuette was a much different candidate than Tudor Dixon, obviously, is. Open seat, right? So a lot of those fundamentals are different. But, you know, in this case, I think from Governor Whitmer's standpoint, is much like 2018, she started looking at reelection early, and you sort of build what your strategy is going to be, what your tactics are in terms of implementing that strategy. And I think as we've seen, with each calendar month that passes, there are more deployment of some of those tactics that reinforces a real message and a real brand that has been consistent from her last election into this one. That's a real machine that just kind of keeps moving forward. On the Republican side, you know, it's obviously been a wild year for gubernatorial politics and Republican candidates. So I feel Dixon in this case has yet to really run a campaign, to be seen, to be heard in any sort of meaningful way. Sooner or later, you gotta turn that spigot on, but I think a lot of folks are waiting to see if and when that happens.
So we're in mid-September now. If you were managing Tudor Dixon's campaign, what would you be doing?
So I'll say a couple of things from a high level. One is, I think it's clear that Dixon was not ever in the prime poll position for the Republican nomination until some of those controversies happened with signature collection and people getting kicked off the ballot and whatnot, right? So she had a pretty good amount of time to be able to get ready and to be ready. So when that good fortune fell to her and she became the, you know, DeVos chosen one and some PAC spending fired up, cleared the primary, you know, that you would have a plan and have an idea of who you were as a candidate and how you wanted to position yourself to the public, as well as in contrast to Whitmer. I'm not sure any of that really has been time that has been well utilized. If I were involved in her race right now, there's only so much catching up you can do, and there's only so much time left. So you got to figure out a way to get resources in the door and then deployed. Obviously, now that people who vote absentee like myself are going to get a ballot here in a number of days. So there's really a vacuum of sorts. You know, I actually talked to my parents over the weekend, and they are in the middle of the UP, and they really have no idea, they couldn't even name who the candidate is running against the governor. let alone anything about her. And I think that's a much broader issue than just my parents in Berrigan County.
But Tudor Dixon is attempting to get out on social media and get her name out there. What else could she do at this stage in the game? She doesn't have the money to go on broadcast. Do we got to go back to the days of a bus tour? Is that an answer, or is even that kind of antiquated in 2022?
I think she could be doing a lot more with earned media, and there are a number of ways to get that kind of attention. I get her campaign update, you know, email newsletters, some of which come out 10 o'clock on a Sunday, you know, like it did yesterday. Others are, you know, in the middle of a, you know, middle of a Saturday or kind of whatever that is. But that timing alone of when those things come out, to me, raises a tactical question. Like if you have a comm strategy and that's built in to communicate to your email list, and on social, and you can't seem to do it at a valuable time for open rates and those sorts of things. Right now, it seems sporadic. Those, again, are just kind of some basic problems. But yeah, earned media, you know, there's always a way to command some earned media attention, you know, despite the fact of not having sizable resources to be able to get up on TV. So there's different ways to do that. But I mean, she needs to be doing that. And she needs to be visiting Republican heavy counties and municipalities less and start getting to kind of that middle swath of voters to be able to introduce herself to.
One of the perspectives that I've seen in this campaign, I don't know if you share this or not, but with Donald Trump, it seems as if the attention is always on Trump. And I know that he's really kind of the titular head of the Republican Party right now. But it's as if he's always raising money, and I know all political candidates are always raising money these days, but for Trump, it's all the money's going to Trump, and very little of it is getting trickled back to people that he endorses who actually really need it, in this case, Tudor Dixon. So in Michigan, it seems like maybe the traditional folks who you would expect to give money to the Republican ticket aren't doing so. I mean, we got Bill Parfet, for crying out loud, supporting Governor Whitmer today. He was big into Snyder. But Trump is not getting that money down to where it's needed, to DiPerno or Karamo or Tudor Dixon. Have you noticed that as well?
Yeah, I think we're still, with every passing election, right, we're still understanding, I think, the control former President Trump has over the party faithful and some of the consequences of that. So to your point right now, yeah, I mean, he continues to suck up significant resources. And then I think in this particular 2022, more so than we've seen before, right, is this idea of election deniers. And I think there are good longtime Republicans who are choosing to withhold resources or to go, in fact, with a more moderate mainstream candidate like Governor Whitmer because of that major issue by itself in some cases, let alone combined with some of these other stances that Perno or Karamo or even Dixon have articulated thus far.
As you're taking a look at this race as it stands right now, what are you projecting is going to happen with Whitmer, the abortion proposal, and the other two top of the ticket races?
If I were a betting man, I think the advantages continue to lie heavily with Governor Whitmer, with the Reproductive Freedom for All campaign in terms of both passing. And I do think Nestle and Benson will win as well. Part of that is in contrast to their particular opponents, but part of that is resource advantage. And as of right now, you know, again, that kind of strategy, that message, that positioning, they seem to be doing better than their opponents.
What about the term limits ballot proposal? How do you see that shaken out?
You know, I still sit back and think once in a while, Kyle, this is a big change to the status quo from what we've known, and hardly anybody's talking about it, right? Because there are these kind of these bigger forces at play. I tend to think that the drafters of that understood the power of that accountability and transparency element, which will help it. I don't think it'll be a landslide like some of the polling indicates, but I mean, I do think it will get 50% plus one.
Promote the vote too?
I think that passes.
Do you?
With some comfort.
What do you think about the House and the Senate? Where do you see things lining up there?
I mean, it's hard to make predictions, right? Because it's still early in a lot of those races. And we're still seeing kind of some of these bigger forces come together, right? So I do think Whitmer's going to do well. I believe on this podcast, you talked about the notion of Grand Rapids, right? And all of those house seats. I mean, I think Kent, I think Oakland are going to continue to drift further to the Democratic side than maybe they have before. So I think there's a chance, obviously, of a flip in both chambers. The Senate seems to be a little better positioned for a flip than the House at this point. But if Dixon really fails to be able to make a splash on TV, Superno, Paramo, you know, same problems, then that's going to all bode well, I think, when it comes to some of those down ticket races as well, who are, because Democrats have done well, I think, in fundraising across the board compared to past cycles. It's not just Whitmer. So, you know, I think both are competitive. I think the Senate would be more likely to flip than the House.
Do you still have any communication with either the administration or the reelect campaign?
Yeah, you know, I continue to have friends and colleagues in both places. And yeah, you know, I mean, there are different communication channels that we keep fresh to talk about, you know, what's going on and are people missing something? Is there something maybe that can be done a little bit better or more effective?
What grade would you give the campaign so far?
The Whitmer campaign?
Yes.
What point in the calendar does that campaign start? Right. I mean, I think through the early, I'm trying to get my months and years straight. I think the early part of 21, right? I mean, they suffered a couple of blows that in some cases were unforced errors. But then I think, you know, around the second quarter, 21, going, you know, into the summer, into the fall, I think from that point on, they've done extremely well. They've got a message they're committed to. They deploy it frequently and effectively. And like the announcement today with Bill Parfet and the others that you mentioned, you know, they have these things lined up and ready to go, right? I mean, it's a professional operation. You know, they know what they're doing, they know how they're going to do it, and they know when they're going to do it. So they're doing extremely well, I think.
All right, Mark Burton. He is now with the Hodgman Law Firm, formerly with the MEDC, and also worked with the governor when she was governor and when she was the Senate Minority Leader as well. Appreciate you taking a little time and speaking with us here on the MERS podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks, Kyle.
If they tell you how to do your job, just do your job. If they tell you how to do your job, just do your job. If they tell you how to make it work, just make it work.
Joining us now on the podcast is Republican gubernatorial candidate Tudor Dixon. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk at the very beginning here. Late last week, you put a challenge out to reporters. You told them it was time for us to do our jobs. What did you mean by that?
Well, we'd like to hear what the important issues are in this race, and I would like the opportunity to talk to people about what my plans are for the important issues in this race. And so far, when we've had reporting on the gubernatorial race, it seems as though the focus has been on an issue that has nothing to do with the governor's race, which is abortion. Now, we would like to talk about what I'm talking about with people across the state, and that's education, that's corruption in Lansing, that's the economy, that's infrastructure, and that's crime. The crime rates have risen through the roof. There is no accountability for what's gone on in the last 4 years, and present company excluded, but that seems to be that these reporters have come around the governor and kind of protected her from her record and are pushing back on an issue that doesn't have anything to do with the governor's race.
But isn't abortion the number one issue that people are talking about right now in this state since Roe versus Wade got overturned?
But that's not something that the governor has any impact over. And it is not the number one issue. When I'm out on the trail, it is not the number one issue I'm hearing. People can't afford their groceries or gas. This is an issue that is being pushed in the media. It's an issue that's being pushed on commercials. You have a court ruling last week that now makes abortion legal in the state of Michigan. So really, this is just an emotional issue the governor is trying to push out there to cover up her record.
But I think what the governor and the Democratic Governors Association is trying to claim is that you aren't being consistent when it comes to this issue. And maybe that's more than anything else, because you told me a year ago that you didn't want any exceptions for abortion. And now you do have exceptions.
No exceptions for rape or incest. You asked me about exceptions for rape or incest, and you asked me about exceptions for health of the mother. I say I have exceptions for life of the mother. Those terms are different.
Do you think the governor is being consistent on abortion?
I think the governor has not come out and said where she stands. She has no limits, and that's concerning to me. It's not the issue in this race, though. Here we are again focused on abortion. This is exactly what I'm talking about. What are you hearing from people out there? Because I've heard that businesses have closed. I've heard that people don't have jobs to go back to. We've lost 3,000 restaurants. The Restaurant Association tells me that they've struggled to get a response from the governor when they have asked her what she's going to do to help. She's also putting out commercials that are totally inaccurate. She's saying that she brought automotive jobs back to the state. In fact, we're now down 5,000 automotive jobs. Overall, we're down over 120,000 jobs. The state of Michigan has not bounced back from the pandemic like other states have, and it's directly because of the policies that this governor has. If you look across the state, one consistent complaint I get from any business owner is that the governor has used her agencies to weaponize against the people. She has used her agencies to go in and cite businesses. This is consistently still happening. Beyond the pandemic, she has used her agencies to close businesses, to cite businesses, to fine businesses. This is different than any other governor. They feel as though it's very challenging to do business in the state. And I've had multiple businesses say, we're planning on leaving because we just can't work under Gretchen Whitmer's administration. Those are some of the biggest issues. But then look at education. This is also something we're not talking about. We just got our education scores back. I will hear the media touting that she's putting more money into education, but what about the results for our children? When are we going to start talking about the fact that Michigan's kids are severely behind? Michigan, before the pandemic, was 38th in the nation in education, and now we're headed toward being in the bottom five states in the nation in education. When are we going to start talking about what are we going to do to make sure there's no wrong path in education for our kids in the state of Michigan? I haven't heard an answer from the governor on how she's going to catch our kids back up, but I hear from parents every day, I need to find out what the answer is to get my kids back on track. In fact, I spoke to a friend of mine the other day who her daughter, we just talked about my kids going into fourth grade. She has a son who's going into fourth grade, and she said, are your daughters able to read? And I said, yeah, but my kids have been in school. She said, my son's been out of school for off and on for 2 years, and I'm sitting at home reading with him every night, but he's missed that crucial step, and the school doesn't have the resources to catch him back up. So when are we going to talk about the fact that every year for the next 18 years, we're going to have kids that have missed 2 years of a crucial step of education? How do we get into those schools, catch them up? But over and above that, the schools were already behind. What are we going to do to make sure we are not in the bottom five states in the nation? Because we need to get people to move to the state. We're losing population. And if you lose population and you don't have people moving to the state, you can't convince them to come if your schools are rated poorly. Crime rates is another thing we're not talking about. You know, you just saw the crime rates come out. It's an absolutely horrendous number. Statewide, it was an over 8% increase in crime. Nationwide, 4. We're twice the national average increase in crime. But when you look at certain areas, you've got a 30% increase in certain areas and over 700% in carjackings in the state of Michigan. This is outrageous to think that we are not focused on those issues right now. This is what this race is about.
You referenced agencies going after businesses. Can you tell us what businesses and what agencies we should be looking at?
Yeah, it's absolutely every business that I talk to across the state, whether it is a farming industry. I just had a dairy producer tell me that they had the environmental agency come in, and they said, you know how it is when you have an agency come in, you know the people, you go around, you take a tour with them. And he said, you haven't a sense of what they're going to talk to you about, what the report is going to include at the end of your meeting. He said, this has been the most bizarre situation. He said, we had them come in, And I received a report that he said, I don't know how else to describe it other than offensive. He said this report had language in it about my dairy farm that I'd never heard before. It's more citations that I could have imagined and fines out the wazoo. He said, honestly, it made me think twice about whether or not I want to continue in this industry. I've had builders tell me it used to take me 2 months to get a permit to build on the lakeshore. Now it takes me 8 months. I've even talked to some of our big auto companies who have said it's so challenging to cut through the red tape and the agencies in Michigan. We can't get the permitting. We don't feel like people are coming around us saying we're in the race to EV vehicles with you. So when you see us opening facilities in other states, quite honestly, it's the fact that when we go to places like North Carolina, Kentucky, Indiana, Tennessee, those states are coming around us and saying, we're going to make it so that you have all your permits and licensing in 60 days. They said in Michigan, we're looking at 8 months to a year, and we just can't wait that long to start producing, because if we're not producing, we're not making money. Across the board, no matter what industry it is, I hear the same things. We are under attack. And things don't move fast enough in the state of Michigan. There's no partnership here. It's government against business. And that's catastrophic.
Ms. Dixon, you had talked about phasing out the income tax as part of your plan for state government. Do you see raising other taxes, like let's say the sales tax, to make up that difference? Or do you see it the deficit being closed by cuts and economic growth?
Well, we know that right now the legislature has already offered the governor two reductions in income tax, and she vetoed both of those. So we went down to, I think it was 4.1 and 3.9, and it might have been 4.0 and 3.9. I think that we can go down to 3.9 right away, but it is something that we would have to phase out over time. So we've looked at a couple of different options. One of those is the earned income tax credit for lower income families. So we can get money into the pockets of the lower income families quickly, faster, and we can phase it out that way. There is the opportunity for a tax swap. That would be something that we would have the people vote on. And obviously they would decide if that's the route they want to go. But we want to do it so that we phase it out and it's not really felt. This is something that it's not felt in other areas, but we are getting money back in the pockets of the people.
I want to ask you about something you tweeted earlier. I think I said it was late last week now, about education pay rates. I think you quoted them at going up 1.09% last year. How do you raise that as a governor? I mean, obviously you can sign appropriations bills, but how do you force that all the way down through the system?
Well, the concern is why isn't the union working to get the money that when we see these increases in education budgets, why isn't that going to the classroom? And so that's something that we need to hold the unions and the administrators accountable for, because we're being told, and I'm being consistently told, that our teachers need more money and they need more money in the classroom. And that's the answer to making sure that our literacy scores are up. If you look at our literacy scores from spring, we're looking at nearly 60% of our third graders failing their literacy exams. In some areas, that's up to 90%. The overall answer I get to that is we need more money in the classrooms. Well, if we need more money in the classrooms, why is it that this increased budget goes in every year? And every year there has been the highest number of dollars going into the education budget under this governor, but it hasn't gone to the teachers or the classroom. So that is my question to the people that are getting this money. When are we going to see this money go down to the places that we so desperately need it? When I talk to teachers around the state, they feel like they're underappreciated, that they're not getting enough. We keep raising the budget. Where is that money going? I want to hold them accountable to that.
One of the citizens initiatives that are going on right now has been turned into the Secretary of State has to do with education, creating these private savings accounts that people can donate in, get money taken off their taxes for. It's tax deductible. And then that money can go toward private school tuition. Is that something that you support?
Yes, absolutely. I think that if you look at when you want to see if we can have true results in our state, you look at Florida, they did something very similar to this, almost the exact same program. They used to have schools in the bottom 10 in the nation. They implemented this system that you're talking about, this bill that you're talking about, and now their schools are in the top 10 in the nation. These are proven results. So when people say, well, this will hurt the education system, you have to look at states that are already doing it and understand that it's not hurting the education system. In fact, students are having a better literacy rate across the board in the state of Florida than they are in the state of Michigan. So if we can model that same program in the state of Michigan and ensure that our kids are having the best possible outcome to make sure that they have an opportunity to go into a trade school or to go into a university, that's the best thing for our students. And really, it should be, we should be looking at our students above anything else.
Is that plan, is it fair to call that a voucher?
No, that's, it's not state dollars. That's not a voucher.
Okay, so if people were to call that program a voucher program, you would take exception to that?
Yes.
Okay, would you support vouchers?
You know, we've looked at an education savings account that would be used for just education. And that's something that we'll be talking about in the next couple of weeks. And I'll roll out and I'll come back if you want me to.
That would be great, John.
The state Supreme Court recently just advanced two ballot proposals. One was the reproductive rights for all proposal. Was that a partisan move?
You know, it's not my place to question the integrity of the court, and I would never do that.
Does the same go for the U.S. Supreme Court and them overturning Roe versus Wade?
I don't think, you know, we have to trust our system and we have to trust our judges. And I don't think it helps us to go out there and say that we have a system that's broken.
Have you thought at all about the type of person you would like to see in cabinet posts? What are you looking for, if elected, to lead state government?
Yeah, for me, it's so important that these people have the desire to make it easier to do business in the state of Michigan. And we talked about that, especially in some of our areas where I'd really like to see the community be able to build up from the inside. And if you look at some of our communities, like Muskegon Heights, I'm a Muskegonite. So if you look at Muskegon Heights or even Detroit, some of those areas, it's very challenging if you want to start your own business because the regulation is just so great. It's so difficult to overcome that hurdle if you've never done it before. I'd like to make this state more friendly to entrepreneurs so that we can see people building their communities from within. So that's the type of person that I think about when I think about state government. How can it be someone who wants to partner with those folks that want to start businesses or our existing businesses that understand the importance of watching the state thrive and watching people achieve the American dream in the state of Michigan? That's been something that I've heard over and over again from people. We just feel like the way we started our business 30 years ago, we couldn't do now because there's too much overregulation in the state. So the American dream right now, they feel is lost in the state of Michigan. I want people in positions that say, no, we want to make that a reality, whether that's in ag, whether that's in manufacturing, or whether that's building, whatever that is, whatever our industry is, I want us to be a partner to them, the state to be a partner to them. And also folks that are looking at the future of the state. How do we make sure our kids are getting the best possible education? How do we make sure that our children have the opportunity to go to a tech school or vocational school or a university? When I talk to some of our biggest industries, when I talk to automotive, in fact, they say to me, right now, we're not looking for people with a four-year degree. We're looking for people with a technical degree. And those are some of our highest paid positions. So we have to kind of change that mindset of, if you have a technical degree, that's not a career. Actually, those are the best careers in the state of Michigan. And we need to focus on how to get there. And those are the types of people that I want around me in government.
Have you taken a look at all about what you would like to do with local governments in distress? We had an emergency manager system back in the day, and that system was blamed for the Flint water crisis. Have you thought at all about what you would like to see to help local communities in distress?
Well, we have the system to, I mean, water is definitely one of the biggest issues. So we have a system in place to be watching that. We know that we've put that money into the budget, but I think that we also have to hold those local communities accountable to making sure that they are keeping their community safe. So reporting back, checking those water levels. And then in other areas as well, I mean, we see the Midland floods. That was a disaster, and that was a breakdown between local and state government, where state government was kind of stopping them from being able to fix those dams. And that can be catastrophic. So I think that we have to be very prepared to work closely with those local communities to make sure that they are acting in a safe and proper way, but they also have the support from state government that they need to be able to do that, especially when you look at the water situation.
Early on in your comments, you referenced Lansing corruption. What specifically were you referring to?
Yeah, well, if you look at what happened during the pandemic, a lot of people have many questions about the governor and her choices to keep people in nursing homes, to put people in the nursing homes. And then when people started to question it, Robert Gordon was able to leave with a secrecy agreement. It's a similar situation in the unemployment agency as well, where we had this mystery $8.5 billion that went out in unemployment that shouldn't have. And that director was also given a secrecy agreement to leave. We want to know exactly what's going on in Lansing. We were told there would be transparency under this governor. She came out with her Sunshine Plan, I think it was, and said that there would be no hiding anything in Lansing. It seems as though under this governor, we've seen more hiding than anything, any other governor. And the people want to know exactly what's going on. Even some of these agreements with the big auto companies have non-disclosure agreements signed from the legislators and the governor. We want to know where our tax dollars are going. We don't want all these secrecy agreements happening in Lansing. We want that opened up to the public.
One of your folks who are on the ticket with you, Matt DiPerno, has suggested in the past that there should be a criminal investigation into Governor Whitmer because of what happened at the nursing homes. Is that a path that you think should happen if you're elected governor?
Investigation should be made. We know that there's a report that just came out, and we'd like to see that report, but that's being kept from the people. I can't say that it would be a criminal investigation, but I do believe that we should investigate exactly what happened and know what happened to people's loved ones.
Last thing I wanted to ask about, Shane Hernandez. So when you guys did that video, I just got to know this. So when you guys did that first video, was that the first time you'd met Shane Hernandez when you shot that video on that Friday?
No, actually, Shane had helped me on a couple of other projects before that. So we had met before that. But
oh, okay. It kind of looked like a first date. I mean, I'm just going to be honest. I mean, you guys kind of look like, you know.
I think it was one of those situations where you go, okay, so now you are the chosen person. Come and let's meet and do a video. And it was probably a little overwhelming for him that day, but he's such a champ. He was such a good guy. And he is really a good guy. He's a hard worker. He's good with the budget. He's really a great compliment to me. So I'm very blessed that he said yes.
You're not going to get him a 3% flag for Christmas, are you?
Oh, jeez. You guys are rough.
Tudor Dixon, she is the Republican gubernatorial candidate. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You got a job if you qualify. My arms are open for you. All you've got to do is just walk inside.
Joining us now on the podcast is the CEO of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. He is Brian Peters. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
The Health and Hospital Association just recently put out a report regarding staffing in the hospitals. What was striking to you about that report?
Well, really, two things. On the one hand, it's the first time since we've been collecting this sort of data over the years where we actually saw a slight decline in the overall number of jobs, not only in hospitals, but in healthcare across the board. And we understand some of the driving factors behind that. So that's number one. But number two, I think the headline really remains that healthcare to this day is still the largest private sector employer in the state of Michigan with some 572,000 direct jobs. And so we continue to be a major economic engine in communities throughout the state.
Is there fewer nurses and people getting into the profession because of what happened during COVID, where the system was just overloaded, people were overworked and overstressed?
That's absolutely right. In fact, we know that today there are some 1,700 fewer staffed hospital beds throughout the state of Michigan than there were pre-pandemic. And of course, nothing happened to those physical beds or the equipment that supports those beds. But what's happened is we have lost staff, both frontline clinical staff as well as non-clinical staff who are so important to making a hospital operate on a 24/7, 365 basis. And so you're exactly correct. We've seen the stress associated with this modern healthcare workplace dealing with a COVID pandemic and a series of other issues as well take its toll. There's no question. And folks have certainly headed to early retirement, those who were within a few years of their planned retirement, who just said, you know what, I'm going to call it a career at this point. And we're hopeful that we may be able to get some of those folks back, at least on a part-time basis. We don't think that's out of the question, but the bottom line is we have a pipeline issue, and we really need to look towards the future in terms of training our young people and retraining some mid-careerists as well for healthcare jobs. There's going to be a great opportunity there.
You had referenced that healthcare was the largest employer in Michigan. Is that standard across other states? Is that partly due to our demographics as a state? Could you talk about a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Sure. Michigan is not unique. This is the case in many other states across the country, because if you think about it, everyone needs healthcare. And whether it's a small rural community in the Upper Peninsula or whether it's our largest cities in the state, hospitals are often the largest employer in that community, and they certainly serve an incredibly important purpose, everything from delivering babies at the front end of life all the way to providing urgent care in accidents, to providing acute care and chronic care at the end of life. And so this is something we see in many places. In Michigan, understand that our population is older than most states, which means that we have more retirees and we have more demand for healthcare services at the same time. And so that double-edged sword really does create a particular urgency for all things related to healthcare.
Joining us also here to ask questions, Samantha Schreiber. Samantha, go ahead.
Yeah, so my question is, you know, how has the state legislature and the governor done with remediating these shortages, rather it be through supplementals, legislation? How would you kind of rank their performance as of right now?
Well, it's a great question. And of course, at the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, that is a main focus for our organization and our members, is how can we secure the funding that we so desperately need? How can we address public policy change at the state and federal level? And I would say to your question, they've done a very good job to this point, but we certainly need much more. And what I would tell you is the legislature and the governor collaborated on a recent $300 million budget supplemental earlier this calendar year that was directed towards the healthcare workforce, that was for recruitment and retention, to make sure that we could keep people on the job in healthcare, that we could generate enthusiasm for those who are thinking about coming into the healthcare field. And there's a lot of exciting developments as a result of that. But that funding alone did not solve this healthcare workforce problem. You know, when you look at the fact that our hospitals now have contract labor costs that are at record highs. These are nurse traveling agencies that are charging, in some cases, exorbitant rates for hourly nursing staff. That has caused our underlying costs to skyrocket. And unlike many other sectors of the economy, we cannot pass that cost along to the end consumer, at least not very easily. And so we do need the help, the additional help from the legislature and the governor. When it comes to relief funding, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank our congressional delegation. They've been terrific in a bipartisan fashion, by the way, since the start of the pandemic, to make sure that our hospitals and other healthcare providers did receive relief funding. And that was very important at a time when they needed it most. But, you know, from a public policy perspective, we have a long way to go. We have to make it easier for people in other states and, frankly, from other countries to go through the process to start providing care here in the state of Michigan in our facilities. We need to make sure that everyone in the healthcare space is allowed to practice at the top of their license. So scope of practice issues will continue to be front and center. And then we've learned a lot about telemedicine as a force multiplier and technology, generally speaking, as a force multiplier in terms of healthcare delivery. But a lot of that has to do with the availability of high-speed internet in our rural areas. A lot of that has to do with public policy that says these people who may be licensed elsewhere can or cannot provide care to Michigan patients. There are a host of issues here, but this is going to be, I believe, the issue of our time for the next several years, is dealing with public policy.
Okay. So what about nurse ratios? One of the things that we had heard from nurses, particularly during COVID, they felt overworked. They had too many patients that they were trying to take care of. They just got burned out and they left the profession because of burnout. Wouldn't state mandate ratios on to how many nurses could how many patients a nurse could see, wouldn't that help the situation with burnout?
Well, first of all, our nurses are absolutely heroes, and we have a wonderful relationship with the Michigan Organization of Nurse Leaders, MONL. In fact, they just had their annual advocacy day last week, and I will tell you that they have an incredibly challenging job, no question. They deserve the support of all of us, and by the way, we are unfortunately seeing a rise in the instances of both physical and verbal abuse leveled against our nurses in Michigan hospitals. And we have been calling on the public to show some grace, show some understanding there. And so we love our nurses and we support them. When you think about nurse staffing ratios, you're talking about potentially mandating a one-size-fits-all approach across a state that is very diverse. Every hospital has its own unique patient population. They have their own unique caregiver population. They have their own unique technology, right on down the line. And really, it's incumbent upon our hospital leaders, including our nurse leaders, to develop staffing ratios and policies that work for their unique situation. Secondly, if you were to adopt a law similar to what California did a number of years ago that tells a hospital you must have this number of nurses, well, I can tell you in every one of our member hospitals today, there is a want ad, a virtual want ad, if you will. We're trying to hire nurses. We're desperately trying to find them. The evidence of that is the exorbitant costs we're paying to these traveler agencies. We would not do that if nurses were readily available. And so at the end of the day, you're telling us we can either break the law by not meeting the mandated ratio, or we can simply close the doors to a critically needed service line or unit, or close the doors to the hospital emergency department for the public. I don't think that's what anyone wants. And so we have to be more thoughtful than this. I think mandated staffing ratios, nice idea on the surface. When you really get into the analysis there, I don't think that plays out very effectively.
Thinking a little bit about the schedule for the rest of the year and the fact that it's an election cycle, is there something MHHA would really like to see legislature do in lame duck before the end of the year?
Well, absolutely. I think we've proven that we can be good stewards of this special appropriation funding that I referenced, the $300 million. We know there is still a very significant amount of funding that the legislature and the administration have at their disposal. They're not under any urgent time frame to spend it. And so I know there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not we'll have an additional supplemental here in the lame duck session. But our message to our elected officials is quite simply this. We need that funding support, and we need it now. We have an urgent problem with behavioral health in this state. We have an urgent problem with emergency department overcrowding in many communities. We have staffing shortages in many hospitals. And so the time is now to deliver that financial support, and we can share back with the public how we've invested those resources and how that's made a difference. That's what we're doing in this round, and certainly that's what we'll do in the next round. So that's going to continue to be our main focus. It's all about the healthcare workforce.
What are the present day, you know, societal barriers that would make someone look at the medical industry and say, yeah, that's not for me, no way?
Well, it certainly doesn't help that we have this rise in both verbal and physical abuse leveled against healthcare workers. We know that that's an issue. The good news is we're shining a very bright light on that and really asking for support at the state and federal level to increase the penalties against those individuals who act inappropriately in a healthcare setting, just like there is a federal law that protects airline workers. If you do something on a commercial airline flight, there are very stiff penalties that are associated with that. We don't have similar protections in hospitals and healthcare, and we would certainly like to see that. So I think that is first and foremost. But, you know, when you think about healthcare as a career option, this is something that is going to be available in just about every community throughout the state and, frankly, throughout the country. There are hospitals and medical centers in communities throughout our great nation, and they're going to be good paying jobs with good benefits. And there's going to be a tremendous demand going forward because many of our current healthcare workers are close to 65, and we know COVID or no COVID, they would be retiring and creating opportunities for the next generation. So I think it's a wonderful career, a path. It's a place where you can make a difference. And who wouldn't want to do that? That's really going to be our argument to the public.
Mr. Peters, so what have you seen with the state's auto no-fault insurance reform? Anecdotally, we've heard stories of these quadriplegic patients end up in hospitals for their care. Is that something that you're seeing as a widespread issue?
Well, I think the reality is this has played out just as we had anticipated once the law was adopted, and that is the post-acute care providers would be the first to be severely impacted. And sure enough, that is what's happening right now. If you've seen what some of those organizations have struggled with, I think some have already gone out of business or are on the verge of going out of business. And the next entity to really be significantly impacted, quite frankly, is our member hospitals throughout the state, but particularly those who have level one and level two trauma centers, particularly those who have a significant footprint in the post-acute care space. This is a law that I know was the subject of discussion for many, many years. There's no interest at the current time in revisiting that from a legislative perspective, but I think in the coming year, there is going to be an appetite to look at the evidence. In other words, this has now been in place long enough to say, what are the pros? What are the cons? We all saw the $400 rebate checks. That's certainly a positive. But now let's take a closer look at the negatives and what the impact on access to care might actually be. And are there things we can adjust? That's the way of our system, I think, is to look at how a sweeping new law is performing. And if there needs to be adjustments made, then we need to do that. And I think the perspective of the MHA and our members is we absolutely are going to need to make those adjustments in the coming year.
So last week, I covered a roundtable with some medical and nursing school programs in Michigan and had heard that essentially that professors, faculty are noticing a uptick in students very concerned about the 1931 abortion ban in Michigan or, you know, potential further abortion bans in the state. And, you know, would they want to go to a different state to learn? Would they want to go to a different state to perform their medical duties? You know, how do you see that as a potential barrier for this industry?
Well, it's certainly a very significant topic within healthcare circles these days. I will tell you first off that the MHJ does not have a formal position on the issue of abortion, meaning we're not going to be advocating for public policy change or the ballot initiative on one side or the other, because as you would imagine, we have member hospitals and health systems that are on both sides of this this issue. But having said that, as you said, there's no question that if Michigan ultimately is a state where we have these sorts of restrictions in place, that is going to have an impact on recruitment and retention of certain clinicians, whether that's OBGYN physicians or others. It's certainly going to have an impact on health equity. Health equity is a major focus for the MHA and our members right now, meaning populations of color, we know, have long fared worse when it comes to morbidity and mortality, both for mom and baby. That's been the case for many years. It's unacceptable. So we have to ask ourselves, what's going to be the impact on health equity if we go down this path? Will those numbers, will those metrics look even worse? Because those with means will have the opportunity perhaps to access care by heading to another state across the border. Those without access to transportation or access to those sorts of resources, maybe they don't. And so that's been a real issue of discussion for those who are focused on the issue of health equity. By the way, we know that populations of color right here in Michigan fared far worse when it came to dealing with COVID as well. And so this becomes an overarching challenge for our hospitals and clinicians.
Brian Peters, he is the CEO of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. That's all the time that we have today. Appreciate you joining us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Tudor Dixon for joining us on the show earlier. Mark Burton for joining us on the podcast as well. Brian Peters, the CEO of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. Also, special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. For the boss, John Rurink, and Samantha Schreiber, until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.